a check-in interview with the person who put me on the path to grasp the importance of water. Of course, together with Judith D. Swartz, who introduced me to Zach in the first place. We had him on the show 4.5 years ago, and wow, a lot has happened. He launched Water Stories and has been on a mission to train hundreds of thousands of people in key water restoration techniques while working on projects underground around the world, and we hear of a few amazing examples. What has he seen in the last years? Has the conversation changed? Have institutions who should be all over this topic because of job creation, costly flood and fire prevention, reduced peak temperatures, and not even speaking about the increased agriculture production, have these institutions start paying attention? And how would Zach make the space investable and bankable? If it's true that water vapor accounts for 60 to 70% of the greenhouse effect, while CO2 only accounts for 25%, why do we rarely discuss it? Maybe we choose to ignore it because it means we literally need to revegetate the entire earth. Bring back the marshes, the mangroves, the perennial pastures with trees, and regrow real forests that can bring back rain in strategic places. In short, bring back life, lots of plants, trees, animals back to many places on this earth. Natural climate engineering. It is time we take our role as keystone species super seriously. In this special water cycle series, we interview the dreamers and the doers who are using the latest technology to figure out where to intervene first. They're making or trying to make the investment and return calculations and plans. So what's missing? What's holding us back? Maybe we lack the imagination to back them and try regeneration at scale. We're thankful for the support of the Nest Family Office in order to make this series. The Nest is a family office dedicated to building a more resilient food system through supporting natural solutions and innovative technologies that change the way we produce food. You can find out more on the Nest FO, that is nestfo.com. Welcome to another episode. Today, a check-in interview with Zach Wise, the founder of Elemento Ecosystems. And since we last talked, which was in 2019, January, beginning of the year, so more than four and a half years ago, depending a bit on when you listen to this, he's also the founder of Water Stories. And I'm very much looking forward to talk water, of course, as part of the Water Cycle series, but also to check in on how he's been, what has happened, and basically to see where the world of water is moving. So Zach, welcome back.
Thank you for having me. It's a joy and pleasure to be here.
And first of all, in 4.5 years, we're going to talk about Water Stories, but have you seen the conversation change? Of course, we're trying to push as much attention on water now with this series as possible. But in your experience, you've been way deeper into this specific part of the regeneration movement. Let's say, what would you say in one or two words, the main summary is of 4.5 years. Is it still fighting for attention? Is it getting finally some more? Even though it seems the world is on fire, floods, landslides, like everything screams water, but apparently not enough to the right ears. What is your main takeaway of the last 4.5 years?
You know, I think we're finally getting to the point where people are ready to hear this message. I think when times are good, people don't like to change. And that's just one of the realities of human existence. And we're now getting to this situation where it's so in your face. You know, whether you're looking at extreme fires and then immediately into extreme flooding, ocean temperatures reaching 100 degrees, all this stuff is just right out in front of you. And now we're to the point where the fires aren't just people here and there. If you're not immediately affected by fire, you're affected by smoke. And if you're not immediately affected by the flood, you're affected by the displacement from that flood. So I think a lot has happened. I think we're still very much just in the early adopters phase of things. I see incredible hope in the number of people around the world that are starting to actualize this knowledge, starting to actually do things on their ground. We've seen a number of incredible examples unfold over the past couple of years. Farms being saved from fire.
Comes most to, like, if people ask you, name one example that would blow my mind. What's the one that you always bring up?
Oh, I have a few, but can I pick two? Is that okay?
Of course. Yeah.
Actually, it's going to kind of be three, but they're related. So
we're not very strict on formats here, except for magic wand questions and one bearing. But yeah, go ahead.
But one of the most hopeful that I've seen really firsthand is Rajendra Singh's work in India. And this is someone that I visited since the last time we talked. And I've worked with him quite closely. We created one film together and are creating another currently. And they've revived 13 rivers to perennial flow in this region of Rajasthan.
This is done by 13, because I think last time I've seen articles around, I've not that, like, I need to go deeper into that, but I think it was definitely under 10. And perennial flow, of course, is the magic word here. So not just, oh, we have a nice flow in spring and that was it. No, we have it all year round, which means you can build on it in a changing climate. 13. Wow.
And, you know, not long ago, that was just 7. In fact, when we made it was just 7. But the thing is, the movement has generated such force that now it's happening simultaneously in all these different regions. And so whereas it took them decades to revive the first river, now in just a handful of years, they can easily activate the number of people that they need in order to rejuvenate a river. And so in addition to that, they've brought water back to more than 250,000 wells, caused reverse migration, lowered the temperature 2 degrees Celsius in this region, restored predictable seasonal monsoons.
And now you're going to come up with another example after this. So we have to first, but it's a bit like, okay, when you rejuvenate a river, very basically, I'm going to send, of course, a link. I'm going to put a link to the film in the show notes, but in a few sentences, or rejuvenate for people that didn't listen to our previous conversation, very basically, what do you do? What is the magic there to bring back a river? Just for clarity, this river was there until relatively recent and has not been there, at least predictably and year round, for quite a bit. And this movement has been able to bring back 13 of those.
And it's really just a matter of helping the land receive water. It is in some ways the most simple thing, but there are all these challenges that we run up against when we try and do that. Some of them are policy, some of them are practical. But really, when you look at it big piece structural-wise, the reason these rivers have died is they've been turned into drains. The farm fields have been drained, dredged, drain tiled. The rivers themselves have been dredged. The waters can no longer connect with their floodplain. And then the vegetation has been cleared. So when rain happens, it surges through the system all at once. And then there's no groundwater through that infiltration process to then feed into that river. And so very simply, by just storing water on the land, getting it to infiltrate into the land, we can fairly quickly revive the flow of rivers.
And we're not talking about big dams and huge reservoirs here. We're talking storing in the land that you mentioned very specifically. And then the other piece you mentioned, 2 degrees lower temperatures, that's massive on a big area. So not just near the river. So we're definitely, and that's one of the themes of this series, talking about cooling here, the cooling effect of a rejuvenated river system, basically.
And something really interesting that happens in that process, you know, there's all these, this is part of why water is so understudied, is there's all these complexities that interrelate with each other. But one of the very big pieces is the transpiration of water by vegetation through photosynthesis. And what this does is, in that phase change of water, it actually absorbs a huge amount of heat at the surface of the earth. That heat is transported up in that water vapor, and then as it recondenses back into clouds higher in the atmosphere, it releases that heat at a wavelength that does not interact with greenhouse gases. So this is essentially a conveyor belt system to take heat from the earth and put it out into space. Now, there's all these different factors, like when that water vapor is condensed and dropped out of the atmosphere overnight, now that heat can dissipate instead of accumulate. And we see that the biggest increase in temperatures is actually in the nighttime minimum temperature, because all that water vapor is acting like a blanket instead of having precipitated out. And so in this region, they went from 2% greenery to 48% greenery. And so that huge vegetation difference, along with the extra water, you have all of these cooling processes from the water and from the vegetation that then result in that temperature change. And now that temperature change leads to a change in the process of moisture cycling through that landscape. And whereas they were in a situation that was so bleak, they were having the failure of monsoons in certain years, which was catastrophic for the driest region in India, now those monsoons are regular once again.
And the, is that a process that, like, it does, like, where does it stop in a sense? Of course, this is super understudied, but like you continue this process, maybe go from 48 to 60, 65, 70, whatever is a logical plateau in terms of vegetation. Of course, you need space for other things as well. What do you, like, would you go back to like historic, I'm not saying even the temperature should go down that much, but maybe the main ones that cause trouble, which are the nighttime high temperatures, which are the extremes during the day, etc., which are too high for plants even to grow. Like, where do you see this go? Or where, I mean, it's theory in this case, but if they continue on that path, and it seems like they are, because it's sort of like a flywheel that starts, what would be in 10 years? Or what would it look like or feel like in 5 or 10 years, if you had to imagine?
It's a great question. And I think it's a matter of two pieces. There's the actual vegetative cover, but then there is the matter of how much water is in that landscape and therefore how long can it photosynthesize. We see a lot of landscapes that stop photosynthesizing for lack of water. And now you have accumulation of heat without.
So not only because it's too hot, not only because it's too hot, the plants stop photosynthesis, you're saying because the plant doesn't have access to water X amount of the year, it's not photosynthesis, or because it's then bare soil? What do you mean by lack of water?
Because it doesn't have access to water. The plant needs water to break apart into its positive and negative charge to perform photosynthesis. And so plants, as they run out of water, they taper down their photosynthesis, and then they actually will go into dormancy if forced into dormancy. So in a lot of places where we used to have photosynthesis all year long in the growing season, now, in a lot of places, the landscape is so drained that that photosynthetic period is a month or two after the rainy season. Then all the grass goes brown. Then all the trees can't photosynthesize as much. And now you're ruining the cooling balancing mechanism that's in place. Now, if we can take those landscapes and rehydrate them, we can go from 100 days of cooling potential to 300 days of cooling potential. And now we can help balance out those extreme heats by that essentially, you know, I think one healthy tree is the equivalent cooling power of 10 air conditioners. So each tree that we can keep photosynthesizing through the year is that much cooling that we have at the time that we need it most.
And do you see stories like that? Now we get to the second example, but at this scale, because it's a region, which in India, in any place, but in India, is definitely not small, getting attention from the right people or the right institutions, or do you feel that that's changing? Not just from the people like us in the space that have done the courses, have been on interesting farms, have been in restored land, but let's say also people in cities or in financial institutions, in development banks, etc. Do you get more of those people interested in this kind of content, or are we still too early for that?
I think from the citizen side of things, 100%. I mean, whether I'm talking to a taxi driver or somebody on the street or whoever, when I explain that this guy in India has revived 13 rivers, they're just immediately attracted to it. They want to know everything about it, and they get very engaged with it. We haven't seen a lot of adoption from more corporate financial interests. And I think part of that is due to some inherent friction, and part of that is due to the ways that this movement in India goes about things. And it's, I think, very understandable, even from both sides, if we really want to look at it objectively. For example, one of the biggest parties working against Rajendra's work were the mining companies. Mm-hmm. Because in reviving the landscape and causing reverse migration, now these mining companies had a bunch of people living where they wanted to mine. And so there was a lot more friction to them being able to mine that landscape. When everyone was leaving and going to the city, it was great for the mining companies because everyone was leaving. They had free access to the land. They could exploit it however they wanted. When people started coming back, they didn't want their waters poisoned and destroyed. They didn't want their lands destroyed. And so these companies, I mean, everything from fighting him for years, tried to poison him. And similarly, we see Rajendra actually got involved with the World Water Forum at some point. You'd think the World Water Forum would want to support this work of bringing water to everyone. They actually kicked him out. They threw him out. Because the World Water Forum works as a shell for Coca-Cola and Nestle and all of these water corporations to go into third world countries, convince them to privatize their water supply, buy that water supply, and then sell it to the highest bidder. So there's some real financial interests against this kind of movement because this movement gives power back to the masses. And whittles down the control and the economic viability of some of these resources. I think the easiest way to understand it is that in a water-scarce world, water is incredibly lucrative. In a water-abundant world, water has no value almost. So there's some inherent friction between the powers that control water currently and their financial interests and making a balanced, healthy, stable climate for all people and life on the planet.
And do you see what could be paths to unlock that? I'm not saying get the water corporates involved because they might be incentivized against this, but what would be pathways to movements like this? I'm not saying this specific example in India, but insurance companies or somehow unlocking the potential of entrepreneurship or the potential of companies to get it to other regions. We've had once on zero budget natural farming, also a movement in India, a very strong movement, that BNP Paribas was preparing quite a significant state loan to the region that was starting to really increase that the rollout of that way of farming. And at the end, it became state policy. And so it wasn't no longer needed, which was an interesting twist as well. But it could have been an investment. It could have been, I think it was 800 million or something. It was quite a significant way because simply the state subsidies for fertilizer, for NPKs, for chemical fertilizer were so high that they could pay back this loan just by saving that. So there was a very interesting incentive to train. Do you see things like that around water? Like somehow finding where the pain is and where somebody's picking up this bill, or probably many are picking up this bill, and somehow pulling that forward and say, okay, if we train now a lot of people, because most of it is knowledge, there's not a lot of technology involved, but you start to understand where probably you should intervene first. But somehow pulling that back forwards and say, okay, if we use some kind of financial mechanism to train a lot, actually there is a business case or there's investable a way of scaling this to other regions in India or other places around the world.
I see enormous potential there, and I see it on two different trains of thought. And I'll say the second one is more exciting to me, but I'm going to save that for a second. The first one is in protecting assets. In protecting assets, whether you're talking government, insurance company, or just a private household, in protecting what we have, there is huge financial incentive. And so I think we see this starting to actually unfold in the United States, where in a couple of states, insurance agencies are saying, we won't insure your house. We are taking on no new policies. State Farm and one other has said they're insuring no new house in California. They'll keep their existing policies, but they're going to phase out of the state entirely because there's too much risk, too much cost. Same thing is happening with Florida with another insurance company. And so in these kind of situations, people's only option is to be self-sufficient and resilient. And so now instead of paying their yearly premium to their insurance agent, they should actually be investing that in their landscape to do the preventative maintenance that then enables that property to withstand a fire well, withstand a flood, withstand the drought. So in the private sector personal individual, I think there's huge potential there as some of these support systems fall away and come offline. Additionally, in the insurance conglomerates that insure insurers, I think there's the reinsurers, there's huge financial incentive because they're the people that ultimately pay out in these big disasters. Now, they don't necessarily realize their gains other than reducing their future risk. So it's not something that's going to make them money. It's something that's going to save them money, which is a little bit harder of a pitch and sell. But then the third piece, which I think is the most hopeful, is the possibility for microfinancing loans and to specifically go into areas that are agriculturally underperforming because of water scarcity. And when you go into those areas and give them a small loan to implement water resiliency, now you take that community and you immediately give them the source material they need to drastically increase their agricultural production. One project I visited in India, the community was out of water. They could only farm on 9 hectares because all their wells were dry. They put in 27 wells and they were all dry. They spent huge amounts of money trying to fix it, couldn't. And then they put in one water body. That one water body enabled them to go from 9 hectares to 650 hectares. And they produced 4 times the cost of that one water body in an increase in their agricultural productivity. So, you know, they needed X money to create the water body. In the first year, their increased revenues were 4X, and that's going to continue year after year in perpetuity. So I think something like what water.org has done for microfinancing of sanitation, we need microfinancing of landscape regeneration. And in so many of these cases, we see that these small effective loans have a very high repay rate. I think water.org has like a 98-99% repay rate. And so their fund keeps growing because they're not just giving money away. They're saying, we're going to give you money. We expect this much in return. And then their fund keeps growing. So I actually had this concept a couple of years ago that I'd love to implement someday of a water bond, where we'd take money and we would grow the overall value of that bond by implementing projects in key areas where we know it's going to be effective, where we know after this implementation, this community is going to be able to repay this loan easily. And I think this also has another piece of goals and directives set by, and then monitoring is set by the top level of governance, and implementation is set by the bottom level. This was done with the Rhine River restoration and was incredibly effective. I think a lot of times these top-down movements fail because the people setting out the directives and everything that's to be done
are far away.
They don't have any connection with the land. Whereas instead, like with this Rhine River, they said, we want these different metrics to all improve. We have these goals to ultimately accomplish. We're going to give the local people the money. And as long as they keep producing and improving on those metrics, we're going to keep giving them the money. And it was incredibly effective. They accomplished all their goals in a shorter period of time with less money than they anticipated. They even accomplished their really far out goals of salmon starting to be on the river again. And so I think we can follow this model where we can let the people on the ground actually determine what exactly needs to happen and where, and let the people at the top just fund it and say, we're going to follow these metrics. And as long as these metrics are continuing to improve, we're going to keep giving you the funding. Now you're leveraging both of their skills and abilities really well. You have the vision and the strategy of the higher ups, and you have the land-based connection of the lower people on the economic food chain, so to speak. And so you can be very effective by harmonizing these two groups together instead of one imposing their will on the other in either direction.
But you do ask quite a bit of, let's say, letting go of control from the top-down way of working, which is not something they're used to. If you had to do that, pick a landscape, and then we go to the second example. Don't worry, we didn't forget. But if you had to pick a landscape, what would be those metrics, and how would you somehow how would you measure them, of course, depending on the metrics, in a way that, that everybody would agree on that? Because, of course, there's payouts and then, let's say, and there are payments bound to that. So we need something that is easily measurable and nobody can argue about it. What would you do in a landscape of your choice, and how would you structure a bond like that?
It would be different metrics in different places. And there are a few simple key metrics that you could really look at to control based on your goals in doing the project. If your goals in doing the project are reviving a river, I think dissolved oxygen and electrical conductivity and flow rate are three simple metrics that take...
Dissolved oxygen, what do you mean by that?
Dissolved oxygen is how much oxygen is in the water. So that's usually going to relate to temperature, and that is going to determine how much life that water can support. Mm-hmm. And so we see in rivers that are dying, in running low, in high toxicity loads, lots of agricultural runoff, we see very low dissolved oxygen. Fish are dying, aquatic life is dying, that river itself is dying. So the more we can increase our dissolved oxygen, we know that the health of that river should be trending in the right direction. Similarly, with electrical conductivity, that's measuring how much salts are in the water, how dirty is the water. The more that, you know, all those salts are being infiltrated into the landscape and used in the landscape instead of in the waterways where they're not wanted, again, that waterway is improving. And then just the flow rate and seasonality of that flow rate is a huge metric.
It feels like all of these are relatively easily, and you don't need probably too many points as well, or too many measurements. You can sort of, I think, I don't remember who said it. I'm going to say Mark Shepherd or maybe Gabe Brown. But anyway, the health of a farm, you can see on the runoff, or you can measure it like at the lowest point, you can measure the quality and water quality. I really don't remember who said this, but anyway, you shouldn't have runoff, obviously. But at the same time, you can see there whatever happened upstream. In this case, the same as the river. If you have no flow, of course, you cannot measure it at the bottom. So that doesn't seem to be too complex. Would you add any others to it, or these three are give a good base?
Those three are the really simple ones that can be done by citizen science, that can be done by anybody. Now, as we have different management goals, we might actually have some different metrics. For example, I could see for this water bond, one of the metrics of success just being agricultural productivity of that area. How many kilograms of X crops did this area produce? And you will see, you know, if you're being effective with your water work, you will see a real increase in that. Similarly, quality of life, if it's primarily as an aid thing to improve quality of life, you can have these qualitative metrics that'll show that very well. Now, if we're instead measuring for, or our goals are to control extreme temperature and extreme climate, now I would look at actually measuring photosynthetic potential of that landscape. And this is something that exists, but is not very well known, but essentially with an infrared camera and a camera that is either trained on red or blue waves, you can actually deduce how much photosynthesis a plant is performing by how much red and blue light is reflecting versus the infrared light that's then being absorbed in that process. So you could actually put cameras on landscapes and build out this metric and say, okay, because of our work, these plants are photosynthesizing 100 days longer each summer. And if you really wanted to get crazy with the calculations, you could probably figure out the net cooling that that is providing as a result.
And would that be something you can do with satellite imagery, or that's too far? Like a remote sensing?
The people that have tried to do it with satellite imagery that I've talked to say that the resolution is too coarse.
Okay.
And so you actually can't get much in the way of valuable metrics. Now, with the latest agricultural drones that are coming out, they have infrared cameras on them, a lot of them. So you could very much do it with drone photography. But from the people that I've talked to about it, they say the resolution on satellite stuff is just too coarse to get a good reading on it.
And of course, it depends on, I mean, from your experience of water stories, et cetera, like which part of this quote unquote pitch resonates the most? I know it depends, but is it the extreme temperature? Because that sort of suggests that in a landscape, which we've seen in India, but still that suggests that somebody knows that in a landscape, if you revitalize the landscape, temperatures will drop. Is it the water all year round? Like what's, is it maybe the agriculture production? What's the story that resonates the most with, not with people in general, but I would say with institutions?
It's going to change depending on where those institutions are. Some institutions are very interested in the fire mitigation side of things. Some institutions are very interested in water quality improvements that can be achieved by this. Others are really interested in the groundwater recharge effects. I think this is one of the problems with our current policy framework is everything is so divided. You know, we have the people working on fire over here and we have the people on water working over here. And they're barely ever talking to each other. And in any kind of natural system, you need this whole systems view where you actually look at everything as one cohesive unit because it's not all these tiny different reductionistic fields. So it's, you know, we've actually had a lot of people from water districts, water boards, and fire departments join our community. So I think people really hear it and understand. I know I've given talks to firefighters where they're just like eyes open wide at the end of it. And they know the situation they've been dealing with for the past 10 years is not natural and not necessary. I think it really comes down to which of these things has an area been most affected by, fire, flood, or drought. Sometimes it's going to be all three. Sometimes it's going to be one of those and barely the other two, or some mix of all three. I think the story that financial institutions are not yet being engaged with, that they should be, is that if you don't care about the planet at all, you don't care about people at all, you just want to save money, this still makes sense to do because we can do a little bit of preventative work now to save the billions of dollars of payouts that happen in a big fire, in a big flood, in these big events. And, you know, we could even use these events as times to redesign our system. One of my biggest pet peeves is one of these events goes through and everyone rebuilds exactly like how they did. And it's just insanity to think that it's going to be any different the next time if we don't redesign at that time when everything's destroyed. We're not losing anything to redesign. We have all this money to redesign and rebuild, and then we do it exactly the same way and expect a different result.
And it's a good moment to switch. The second example after the 13 rivers, what is the other one you always mention? And maybe a third, because you hinted towards a third one.
Yeah, and I'm actually going to combine these two into one because they're the same story, two different projects. One project that we did in California, it saved the house twice. Once from fire, once from landslide. The fire came through, all of the neighbors, ashes. This property, fine. Then after the fire, you get all the landslide. The house was down at the bottom of the gully. The landslide would have taken it out, but the water bodies that we created caught all of the landslide debris. And so, yes, it had to be dug back out to be a water body once again, but it very clearly saved this multi-million dollar house twice, once from fire, once from landslide. Similarly, another project, a friend of mine in Australia that I visited, Peter Marshall, he had the fires in 2020 when Australia was just crazy. I was actually over there at the time. He had the fires swirling around him for 2 months, coming in from every different direction, but his property didn't burn. He was turning crown fires where it was growing, flaming all the way through the crown of the tree to ground fires that he could put out with a shovel. And it was because of his water management and his forestry management that this place was so defensible. So again, all the neighbors' ashes, this place totally fine. And so it's very clear we know what we can do to make landscapes resilient. But both of these projects I just mentioned, the one in California, everything we did was illegal. And the one in Australia, he's paid $1 million of fines for doing what he did.
And after, like the one in California, did something change in terms of neighbor interest, in terms of local, like, or are they still being annoyed or pushed by the fact that what they did was actually illegal, even though it saved their house twice?
I haven't been back there since. I've just gotten letters from the client talking about it. So I don't know how their neighbors have looked at it. I know that policy has not changed as a result, but that's also because we have to be pretty quiet about it, because we would put this client at risk to make a nice video about this project and show exactly how it worked and what we did to fix it, which is exactly what we should do so that other people can do it. But we're directly putting that client at risk by doing that. So we can't, we can only talk about it vaguely in this way that I'm talking about it now so that they don't get discovered. So I think it hasn't had the impact that it could have and should have because of the policy impediments.
And I think this is a good moment to talk about water stories. What is water stories? And don't all go now on your phone or on your laptop, wherever you're listening to it. I will put a link below. But what is water stories? What was the reason behind setting it up? Because when we talked 4.5 years ago, I don't think it was even there yet. Maybe in your head, but definitely not on the web.
And not even really in my head yet. I mean, it came from a conversation with Sepp Holzer, who has been an amazing mentor to me, has just totally changed my life. He said that he called me his best student, but then he said, and this is what I love about Sepp, he's always looking to the next thing. You know, he'll never really say much nice about people, but if he does, he's going to immediately give you the next thing you should be working on. And so he calls me his best student. And then he says, but one of you is meaningless. We need hundreds or thousands of you. Millions would be better. And this was really, it took me a little time for that all to set in. But I really realized I can work myself into an early grave doing every project I can and never spend a minute of my life doing anything else. And it will have no meaningful impact as far as where we need to go and what we need to do. And that really opened my eyes to that I need to train as many people as possible to have all the same skills that I do in terms of being able to read landscapes and make positive changes. Then around this same time, I met Rajendra Singh for the first time, and I started to understand the incredible power of community-based movements. And so with these two ideas combined to form Water Stories, which is part awareness about everything on the water cycle, films and stories of a new mythology for humans that recognizes our ability to enhance and to create and make the planet better, healthier, stronger than ever before. And it's also a community where people can come and learn from one another, connect with one another. And then we also have courses really geared around training people to do what I do in one form or another. Maybe they do it professionally, maybe they do it as an advocate, maybe they do it as a land steward, but to have the same core abilities and understanding that I've had the incredible blessing to be able to learn from a Sepp Holzer and a Rajendra Singh and all of the other great leaders and heroes that I've had the great fortune of spending time with.
And I think the training piece was already there when we talked, because you were talking about how do I scale myself, or how do I train the trainer, or maybe not train the trainers, how do I train replicate myself or clone, which obviously we don't want to, but how do we do that? Because I'm just not going to hit the number of hectares simply that we need to hit by myself. It's just not possible. What has been your biggest lesson from maybe on the courses side, like how to train other people? How difficult is it? Because it's so context specific and there must be so much knowledge in your head. How has that experience been training others to do similar work? Not your work, but similar work. What's the biggest lesson there?
That's a great question. And, you know, when we were speaking last, I was going with a very different strategy where I wanted to give a lot of effort and focus on very few people to hopefully create really good practitioners. And I learned that that was just too slow, too slow and not going to work. And, you know, we took on 5 apprentices, 3 of them turned out to be really good and continue to work with our crew. But, you know, if I'm training 3 people in 2 years, we're not going to get anywhere. And so I really recognized that I needed to figure out a way to scale in the modern world. And I think that, you know, I'm actually amazed at how effective it's been. I try and take people through 5 years of my life in 6 months. And so I really try and distill things down to what are the most essential pieces. All of the extra fluff that might be nice, but is not necessary, just let's just throw that out because there's too much to cover already. And I expected that it would work in a couple of years, that we'd take people through this 6-month program, and then in a couple of years, they'd be working as a professional or doing projects. But what we find is because our program pushes people to action throughout the whole program, I think that's one of the things that I've really learned as part of being education is if you just show people, they're not going to do it. You have to show people and make them do it. And then they can do it on their own. And so our course is very heavy on actions. Every module has a bunch of actions that people need to go out and do on the landscape. So we say it's online, but it's really at home. And what this has done is it has enabled this system where, you know, in 6 months or 1 year, we now have people working, doing this kind of work around the world, being featured in newspapers, starting their own YouTube channels, doing all of these different things that are how they want to contribute to this movement. And it's actually happened so much quicker than I could have imagined. We already have people from 199 different countries in the community. That's like 2/3 of all of the countries in the world almost, or actually a little bit more than that. And, you know, it's just in 2 years' time.
And to play the devil's advocate here a bit, as you are a perfectionist, I'm pretty sure you are. What about the quality of the project? Like, are you scared? Have you seen examples of things just not working and then coming back to you? Or like, what's the quality aspect of this? Which I think is one of the reasons you went for, let's train a few people very close to me so I can make sure they are completely able and they're perfect, et cetera, et cetera. And this is like, in terms of letting go of control, this is a whole different level of that as well.
Yeah. And I mean, you hit it on the nail on the head as far as me being a perfectionist. But I think that's where having people go through all these actions is so critical because we see, you know, a lot of things that need to be fixed or could be better in their first projects. But those first projects are only for us. Those aren't for other people. So people are making their example water body, and I can tell them, hey, your spillway is too steep here, and this isn't big enough, and this isn't right. And so all of their mistakes and failures happen in this environment where it doesn't matter. And it's actually, you know, we want people to make failures and mistakes. Failures and mistakes are how you improve. I think another piece that really helps is, whereas when I was training people direct one-on-one, we were only seeing the projects that we were working on. Whereas now we have this catalog of projects that we've recorded, and we can show people all of them through the process of going through the course. So people see a lot of different examples. They are not just seeing a few, but they're seeing all the different flavors, different climates, different contexts. And so I've seen lots of work in the grading stage that I want to see improvements on, but I haven't seen much work in the actual implementation phase where they're doing it for other people that isn't anything short of exceptional. Now, would I do it in a slightly different way sometimes? Yeah, sure. But my way is not the right way. You know, the right way is someone following nature and listening to that landscape. And that's the part that we train. And that's why I think they're so effective.
And what about the role of technology in this? Not obviously on the courses and education piece, because there the online technology is fundamental, but in general, have you seen things over the last 4.5 years? I asked about remote sensing, but in general, of course, the drone piece that you say, wow, this is really changing, or this could be a game changer. It could be an iPhone moment, let's say, for the sector. Maybe not now, but maybe in a few years, if it keeps developing like that. Have you seen any of that really excites you or not? Of course, that's also an answer.
I would say, you know, from what I see in the land design movement, people are mostly already way too dependent on technology. And so in some ways, I think as the maps get better, people become worse designers because they're not looking at the landscape as much. I can't tell you how many times I walk a landscape and the main vein of the landscape where the springs are coming out, where the water flow is not where you would ever put it on a contour map. It doesn't make sense on a contour map. It doesn't make sense based off of the land shape because it's the geological layering underneath that landscape that actually determines those things. So I was just on a project where, you know, I came in after a big name permaculture designer, and to not mince words, I mean, the design that they had was kind of trash. It, you know, it left all the structural problems in that landscape in place, but it painted over them with a pretty hedge. So, you know, they left all the drains draining all the fields in place, but they made them an edible hedge drain. And so in many cases, we're leaning on these tools so heavily that we're not performing the basic site analysis that we should be. Whereas, you know, I recognize and see how much better the mapping is getting, and I also see that it's making people even worse designers as a result. Now, I will say one thing that is a project that we're working on that would be great if anyone's out there and finds this interesting. We need funding for it. We have the skills, we have the ability, but basically machine learning as a data metric. And where we could essentially have two different devices, one that would be a macroinvertebrate sensor for waterways. Now, instead of people having to go out and perform samples, we could just have a continuous stream of data coming in for the macroinvertebrate levels in those waterways, which is one of our major indicators of health that we use in science.
What are the macro ones you're looking for? Or what are like the quantity?
All of the insects in the waterway. A healthy waterway is full of aquatic insects. A sick, dead waterway is going to have very few.
And so, you need a good sensor that continuously can monitor a waterway, basically, in terms of aquatic insects.
And then actually recognize them as the different types of insects and say, okay, for this amount of flow, we have this many of this kind, this many of this kind, this many of this. Similarly, we want to do the same thing with soil. Right now, if you want to understand the biological constituents of your soil, you take a sample, you put it in a bag, you send it in the mail. It sits in a lab for 2 days, 3 days before they sample it. Now the sample is already way different than it was in the field. And then you get the results a few days later, and it doesn't really enable a quick feedback of management and feedback. Whereas what we're creating is a device that would be in field that you would hook your smartphone up to, you would run some soil through it, and it would tell you all of your different levels of bacteria, fungi, protists, all the different things that you might want to have as a metric. Now, you could take a sample before you plow your field, and you could take a sample after you plow your field and immediately see, okay, what response did my management create? Similarly with spraying something, whether it's a compost tea or a pesticide or an herbicide, you could immediately see what kind of response does that have on my soil. So if we're able to bring either or both of these products to market, I think that could be a huge tool in making the unseen more seen.
It's a very nice way of putting it. I think I have to look back at who said it, but there's an interesting piece on the water and on the soil piece, the air piece as well, I think is to make it, make the air side more visible or the unseen visible would be fascinating as well. I know people are working on the handheld device to be in field, and to basically be instant and still lab worthy in terms of results, because otherwise you're going to be all over the place. And that's not very useful, for any farmer or land steward or practitioner. And would that be, I'm just re-asking the magic wand question, but probably it would be a different answer. What would you change if you had one thing that you could change overnight? And what would that be? Probably not those two technologies, but like, what would that be? Would it be policy? Would it be, which is similar to your answer you gave before, 4.5 years ago, would it be something else? Would it be consciousness? I mean, of course, water stories, more attention would be great. Or if everybody saw the 13 river or the 7 river video that now turned 13, I can't imagine people are not moved by that, but what would you, your magic wand answer?
You know, I've been thinking about this, listening to your other podcasts, and I got one that I think would be really simple and I would love to make happen. If just every person had the same understanding around water that I've gained through the lived experience. So if every person could experience firsthand one of these projects in India, Sepp Holzer's Kramaderhof, some of the projects in Spain, some of the projects that we've done, if they just understood that we have everything we need to live a beautiful, simple, healthy, resilient life. And in fact, if we just care for water and treat it respectfully, we can solve all of the most pressing issues from a climate change. We can't necessarily solve everything, but you know, climate change is something caused by the energy sector and the land use sector, but it's going to be felt in the water sector for all of the people around the world. And so if we could help people understand that that water sector doesn't need to be that way, that we have all the tools, all of the understanding, all of the ability to change it right now. And if everyone understood that that was possible, I think things would just change in the blink of an eye.
And do you think that this new, I haven't used it yet, of course, because it didn't come out yet, but the to stay in the iPhone movement terminology, these new virtual reality, augmented reality, like how do we cannot all bring everybody to Austria, for example, to Sepp Holzer, or to India. Like, is there a way to partly do that remotely? Like you wear certain very, very well done glasses and experience like the transition of a farm like that, like also over the years. I think that's one of the powerful things of The Biggest Little Farm, like the same shot 7 years in a row. Like you can see, of course, production quality, budgets, very, very interesting piece as well. But like you can see the change, you can feel the change. You really feel for the peaches and you really feel for not the snails because they get eaten by ducks, but you feel like you're there. That's not even an immersive one. Do you see something there to somehow bring this to the people instead of bringing the people to these examples? Or are you saying, look, there are examples everywhere. Within a few hours drive, everybody could actually experience this and that's better? Or what's your feeling there?
I think there's a few pieces to that. I think that, you know, for one, we need demonstration projects everywhere because it's going to look a little different everywhere. And in reality, people never believe what they hear. They believe what they see. And so I worry that even if we're able to create an awesome augmented reality experience, people are going to say, oh, well, that's virtual reality. That's not in existence. That's not real. That's someone's imagination. Whereas when you see it in existence on the ground, there's no refuting that. You're there. You can smell the water. You can taste it. You can taste the food. So I think that there's that piece. As far as helping everyone understand, I think this is where stories come in. Stories are the best ways to remember facts and figures. They're what humans have used for our own mythology for as long as we've had language, we've had story. And so I think we don't necessarily need to have this augmented reality to understand that story. In fact, showing people real footage of real projects and real results, you know, now we have all the power to do that. Whether you have a smartphone in your hand or, you know, we have never been more able to create and distribute content easily amongst people. And so I really think it's just in the power of story that this work can spread.
Yeah, no, I'm seeing these, I'm not saying they should be imaginatory or I think it could be a way to for many to visit Sepp Holzer, basically, and to experience that without having to fly from Australia to, but of course in Australia you can visit nice places as well, but like to, and but then always the argument could be, yeah, that's far away, that's there, it works there, just like we see with farmers in transition, like, yeah, but that's another soil and that's another, like there's always an argument, and if you experience it nearby, obviously that argument should go away, it doesn't always. And you touched upon something before when you explained what Water Stories is, and I would like to double click on that. You're like to help people understand like the role we play. I don't think you used the word keystone species, but like the role we play in, like we have a positive, potentially positive role, let's say, instead of just sort of wishing that humanity wasn't there and then everything would be fine. I'm generalizing here, but what have you seen there, or what made you... Do you remember when you realized that, or when you came to that conclusion, like, look, we have a role here, which is actually on the positive side, not just on the negative side? Because I feel like very often we get stuck on that. This feels like a whole different podcast, but we get stuck on the negative piece and not necessarily on taking our keystone species role. And definitely part of the Water Cycle series is double clicking on that and going deeper. So I didn't want to leave that one before we wrap up. What's, you remember when that came to you, or you realized that, was it very early in your career or later on that you like, we have that potential?
That's a great question. It's something that, you know, came up throughout life from childhood onward, but it was really reinforced in meeting Sepp Holzer and not even going to his place yet. It was reinforced to a whole nother level to go to the Kramaderhof. But in just being around with him, spending time with him, understanding that somebody is doing this, that really opened the doors there. And I think a big part of it is in the stories we are told and the stories we listen to. And you can find anywhere, whether it's, you know, in documentaries, in Hollywood TV series and movies, or whether on the news station, it's very clear the story of humans destroying stuff. Humans making the environment worse, humans making the landscape worse. Where are the stories of humans healing the planet? The reality is that they're all over the place, but they're just not told enough. You know, there's these people from, in your conversation with Milan, he mentioned how the water cycle is only operating with half its capacity. Victor Schauberger, more than 100 years ago, was talking about the half water cycle and how what we had at that point was the half water cycle at half functioning. So this is a story that's come up time and time again, and it's been proven time and time again on every continent except for Antarctica and every place, but just the stories haven't spread. Now, I think in a lot of cases when these happened, there wasn't the infrastructure for these stories to spread. There wasn't the internet yet. There wasn't, you know, great documentation at the beginning of these projects. There's not before and after of Rajendra's projects, because 35 years ago when they were starting, there were people starving in the desert. They weren't worried about getting before footage. They didn't think they'd be able to accomplish this. They just started trying.
That's what often
trying.
Is the problem. We don't like keep, like to everybody listening, involved in any kind of these projects, take before pictures, please, because you're going to regret it. Like, rent a drone somewhere. I'm not saying steal one, but like, figure out a way to document as much as possible, because you're going to regret not doing it later on. And now we have, at least most of us have somewhere a decent kind of camera in, not necessarily in our pocket, but let's say nearby. And it's, yeah, it's really interesting that how that might shift over the next years as these things actually have been documented from the beginning, and we can see the massive the before and after, which is still the most powerful thing we have, like those fence line pictures or those pictures of a project here and a project there. Yeah. So that's shifting potentially, and our ability to then distribute the stories, of course, changed completely. And a shout out to you, because me and the interview came out this morning basically, so I don't know when you listen to it, but that was that's impressive. And it's interesting. Yes, there have been people, of course, on this for 100+ years. The question is now, does it feel different? Like, is it like, I'm asking a question here. Do you feel that this, why would this time be different? Why would this this cycle around talking in water cycles be different than all the other ones, where I think also people like bit their teeth and broke their teeth, I don't think it's a way of saying, but on this issue, and somehow didn't get to where we need to go?
I think the key here that will either make or break us is the connectivity between common people. And whereas in previous times, we were always dependent on the conscious awareness of the leaders, of the higher ups, of the oligarchy, of whoever was in charge, we're now at this point in time where we're all so well connected, we could overthrow those systems pretty easily if we set our minds to it. And we don't even necessarily need to overthrow those systems at all. We just need to start doing the work that we can. And so in so many places, there's this incredible disempowerment around the management of land, but it is still the people who live on that landscape, whether legally or not, who are in control of the day-to-day actions that unfold on that landscape. And so I think that's going to be the key difference here, is can we awake the conscience of the common people and have us all collectively start to play a role in this? Or are we going to wait for someone else to fix it? And the reality is someone else is not going to fix it, because they're making a lot of money off of the way things are exactly as they are. And so they have no incentive to change it. And so I think that's the big difference now, is just that in how quickly stuff can spread around and how well connected we are and in how we can support each other and come together. Reminds me of these projects in India. The government wanted to take credit for a lot of the work they're doing. So the government started to come in and do similar type projects, but they didn't talk with the local community. They didn't work with the local community. And now those government projects have totally fallen into disrepair and don't do anything for anybody. And so they can't take credit for it because they weren't actually in connection and they didn't have buy-in from the local people living there. And so we see a lot of these movements happening through this grassroots energy, which I think is what may be our saving grace in this whole mess.
And as a final question, which is a question I didn't ask years ago yet, and which is an interesting tension with the top-down, bottom-up we discussed before as well. What would you do with $1 billion if you had to invest it? So how would you put it to work? My hunch is something through microloans, etc., but maybe something completely different. So if you had this enormous amount of resources, very concentrated, which is in many ways not a good thing, but let's say you did wake up tomorrow morning and that was the case, so you now have the burden of this or the luxury, what would you do and where would you prioritize and how would you go about it?
Yeah, great question. I think it would be a multi-phase process to burn through all that capital in a beneficial way. The first step would really be in an awareness campaign and in lobbying to actually change laws, to create laws that give people the power to steward their water, that give first right of rain to the land where it is received. So much of our problem is in the prioritization of downstream flow, which all of our legal apparatus around water prioritize downstream flow. That is going to, you know, as people have just heard from Milan, that's going to make less and less water in that system. That's so mainlining
first
water.
First right of rain, what does that mean? Basically, the rain that falls on my land, let's say I'm up in a water system, I'm not legally obliged to drain it as quickly as possible down. Is that I can have it actually soak in my healthy ecosystem? Because now I have to push it off my land as quickly as possible.
You don't own that water. The state owns that water, whether it's in the sky, on the ground, or in the ground. And so exactly, basically giving the people to hold water on their land, to create water bodies, to create infiltration structures, to first have that land wherever it meets the earth, first serve that portion of the earth.
The water where it meets the earth. You said land. Yeah, yeah. Okay. So whenever it touches, that's where the magic needs to start.
So that's a big piece of it, you know, really leveraging policy. Because right now we've got this insane predicament where there are lots of people out there who want to do good, but they're not even allowed to do the best good. They're only allowed to do these side projects that won't really make a big difference. And they're not allowed to work in the areas that actually need healing. So time and time again, you know, we see that a waterway that has been turned into a drain, sometimes put in a drain tile and dredged, is now a water resource or a wetland, and you're not allowed to touch it. You're not allowed to do anything with it. So whereas it was a wetland, now it's a drain, and you're not able to fix it from being a drain and push it back towards a wetland. So that policy piece really needs to change for people to be able to actually implement some of this stuff. So outreach and lobbying, maybe 10% of that fund. The rest of that fund, I would just put fully into a water bond and into these microfinancing loans and essentially look specifically for places that are limited in their water resource, that are underproducing agriculturally, and then I think you have a sure bet to get repaid on those loans. And so whether if for financial incentive of making more money or just making the world a better place, you could have all of these additional funds feed back into the water bond that then keeps funding additional projects. We see on every project we do, people would go bigger and they would go farther if they A, had the legal right to do so, and B, had some funding support to do so. And in most cases, they would have no problem repaying that funding. They just don't have the funding on hand. So in that $1 billion fund or that big fund, a big portion of it would be in changing policy, but then the even bigger portion of it would be in funding local projects. And again, I would do it a similar setup as that Rhine River, where, you know, the fund itself would maybe determine we're going to follow these three environmental metrics, and we expect these different checkpoints along your way, and then you get this next bump of funding each time you hit one of those checkpoints. But then let the local people, with some guidance, actually determine what projects and how they spend that funding, and then make that amount small enough that if they spend it on the wrong thing at first and they don't get the metrics, they don't get access to the rest of the funding. So it's really, again, that management goals and directives set by the top, but the actual details of implementation set by the people on the ground.
I think it's a perfect way to end this conversation. There are so many other ways we could take this, but we're already an hour in, and I think we'll keep that for another conversation. I don't think it's the last time we talk. I want to thank you, of course, coming on here, for listening, first of all, and for doing the amazing work you do and coming here to share about it, spread about it. I was going to use another word, come here to check in with us and see where we stand. And hopefully the next one is not going to be 4.5 years, but a bit sooner.
Absolutely. I would love that. I love your podcast so much myself, and I hear so many good things about it from my students. If ever I miss a key episode, they're always sharing it in the community. So really appreciate what you do. Really appreciate you getting this information out to, you know, one of the most critical audiences to understand this. The first time I had dinner with Sepp, he said, when children are raised in tune with nature, when those children become politicians, the silent revolution is complete. And I look at that even a little bit more broadly. Yes, that would be the best way to do it. But if we can get the people in charge of all of these major levers of investment and of policy to understand what we can do from a water standpoint, things can change very quickly for the better.
Absolutely. And I think we're at a point, I mean, I hope that we were at that point a few years ago already, but the conversation seems to be changing and maybe out of desperation, but this is a month just whenever you're listening to this, but Europe seems to be partly on fire, either going through the usual cycle of drought, fire and flood, but actually multiple islands in Greece had to be partly evacuated because of fires. And there, the pain is very real, of course, of the people living there, but also the pain for the tourism industry. And like, there's a very, like, we had heat waves here that we haven't seen in a long, long time. So let's see if this time is different, and people start Googling or start searching for and then find the relevant content. And because it's out there, you just have to look for it just a bit better, but it's out there. The education is out there. It's accessible to almost all, and a lot of this work doesn't need to cost the world or break the bank to get it implemented. And the returns are very interesting. What we need is a lot of creative people to figure out ways to scale this and to figure out bonds and to set it up and to then turn it into really good PowerPoint presentations that would actually get funded. Because that's a whole different job, to get this into Wall Street, into London City, into New Delhi, into Shanghai, etc., because that's a different world, a different language. But we need those bridges, and hopefully we can accelerate that a bit with this. So thank you so much for being here, and thank you so much again for the work you do and for spreading literally the water and the message.
Oh, likewise. Thank you for everything, and thanks for having me, Colin.
Thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. For the show notes and links we discussed in this episode, check out our website, investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/posts. If you like this episode, why not share it with a friend or give us a rating on Apple Podcasts? That really helps. Thanks again, and see you next time.